December 7th, 1941, the date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. These famous words of President Franklin Roosevelt were used to declare war on Japan after the attack on Pearl Harbor, which catapulted our nation into World War II. 1 year later, on December 7, 1942, the Charlotte Observer ran a front-page story reporting that 125 people attended a meeting at Queens College to organize a new church in Myers Park. Our church was born in a time of war, in the wake of a deadly attack on U.S. soil that killed 2,403 people. And we were founded by a people in need of healing, living in the midst of a world in need of healing. One of our founders, Fred Helms, recalled, "World War II was upsetting to all of us. Things were downright serious, and we concluded that religion ought to be downright serious too, that it was time to wake up and get going." Other Baptist churches in town criticized our founder's decision, saying a war was no time to start a church. But Helms replied, "We thought it was a good time because religion is the only ultimate antidote to the stupidity of war." There were already plenty of churches in Charlotte, even in Myers Park. But Myers Park Baptist was not organized, in their words, with the intent of providing a more convenient place to worship, nor to the end that they might build a church at the expense of other congregations in the city. Neither was it, they said, that we might point with pride to what we had done. They said we were organized because certain people became possessed of a dream to meet the needs of the community in a way they had never been met before, a church that was free, truly free, from rigid dogma, fundamentalism, bigotry, and barbarism that characterized so much of religion in the South. Our forebears were acutely aware of the ways traditional churches had harmed many people. So they decided to build a place where people could be their authentic selves, where questions were encouraged, where following Jesus was more important than doctrine or denominational beliefs. When this church was founded in 1943, our world was wounded and in need of extensive healing. They needed healing from the attack on Pearl Harbor, healing from the death and destruction of war. And now, 80 years later, we too are in need of healing again. Healing from the death and destruction that have come from a global pandemic. Just as we do today, our founders longed for healing from many forces. Fascism and genocide abroad, racism and segregation at home, the scourge of anti-Semitism on both sides of the Atlantic, as well as healing from the rigid dogmas and fundamentalisms of so much of religion. Our founders believed that this church could be a place where all people came to find healing from the forces that were wounding and oppressing people. And for 80 years, we have been a house of healing. And today we celebrate that extraordinary history. We have certainly not been perfect. We've had our fair share of fumbles and failings over the years. But despite our errors and missteps, we have been a place where people could come and discover themselves and find the healing that only a beloved community can provide. We've been a place of healing for heterosexuals and for LGBTQ plus folks, a place of healing for men, women, non-binary, gender-fluid folks, a place of healing for rich and poor, white and black and brown, citizens and immigrants, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, married, unmarried, single, divorced, and widowed. People with differing abilities, those with children and without, teenagers to senior adults, people of various ethnicities and religions, atheists, agnostics, and everything in between. And we did this by striving to be an inclusive community for spirituality and social justice where all people were welcomed and affirmed. Since our founding, every generation has become more open than the one before it. And due to our constant and vigilant progression, we have been a source of healing and wholeness for many people. And so, as we remember 80 years of ministry today, we can proudly celebrate who we've been and who we are as a people today. As we celebrate our history, we must also look forward to the future, to imagine where the dream of our forebearers is now going. At a recent meeting, one of our deacons did something quite radical. They took their iPhone out of their pocket and held it up for the rest of the deacons to see and said, "We're trying to lead a church where parents are raising the first generation of kids who've never lived in a world without these. Without smartphones." It was rather dramatic. Scholars describe the invention of the smartphone as the most revolutionary technological advancement since the printing press in 1450. You know, the printing press ushered in the Renaissance and the Protestant Reformation. Church decline in America was already at an all-time high when the iPhone was created in 2007, which, for reference, was the year after I graduated from seminary. So I have to admit that I learned nothing about doing ministry in a smartphone age while in seminary. Things are moving, changing faster than ever before. Many of the old evils remain with us, while new advancements bring fresh evils and new wounds that our bodies and souls are trying to deal with, just trying to figure out, and crying out for healing. In his book, The Healing Wisdom of Africa, Maladoma Somme writes, "Western civilization suffers from the ills of loneliness and isolation, the absence of supportive community, feelings of anonymity, apathy, and consumerism, which distract people from focusing on the things that matter most deeply to them, causing a spiritual hunger so dramatic as to be almost frightening. Our hunger for healing is rooted in a crisis of identity and purpose." From an indigenous perspective, Somme argues, "We have been alienated from our true selves, and it is only by developing rituals," he says, "that reconnect us with our true selves that we will be healed." Rituals, according to Somme, are not ceremonial practices with clearly predictable content and outcomes like a Sunday morning worship service. Rituals shake us free of the rigidity of the ego that wants to limit our growth. They are designed to reconnect us with ourselves by recovering our memories and remembering our identity, reaffirming our purpose in life, which is where our healing, true healing, really comes from. Community, ritual, and healing, he says, are vitally linked together. Somme claims there can be no healing without community and ritual. It's interesting, the word healing does not appear in our church covenant, but the words community and ritual figure prominently. One of my favorite lines is that we will sustain a critical examination of scripture, belief, and ritual as interpreters of God's active presence in the world. Throughout our 80 years, we have been strong in our examination of scripture and belief, quite stronger than in our examination of ritual. Perhaps if we believed ritual was the path to our healing, we might examine it more thoroughly. We don't have many rituals specifically designed for the purpose of healing as a church, which is strange, given that that is what so many in our community continue to say that they are longing for, desiring. Perhaps it's our cynicism about the old practice of faith healings that we saw at revival meetings, televangelists promising miracle cures. True healing, though, is not a sideshow act or a miracle cure. True healing is far more expansive than any cure. There are countless situations in life where a physical cure is simply not possible. But true healing is always, always possible, even when there is no cure, through the medicine of community. Everyone in our society is suffering with trauma, and yet very few seem to be finding true healing. Why? It's because we often want a cure, a quick fix, a fast remedy to make the pain go away. We don't really want healing if we think about it. And if we do, we struggle to find it because we imagine healing is something that happens automatically. How does the old phrase go? Time heals all wounds. Sounds nice, but it's not really how it works, is it? I prefer John Lennon's version. Time wounds all heals. H-E-E-L-S. True healing isn't something that happens automatically. We have to become active participants in our own healing. We have to do the work. Some of you know that I partially tore the ACL in my right knee recently. The good news is that I will not have to have surgery. The bad news I found out is that I will need physical therapy. Can you imagine if I looked at my doctor and I said, you know, I appreciate your suggestion about physical therapy, but I think it's going to heal fine on its own. I'm just going to let time do the work that it needs to do on my knee. Yet that's how many of us approach our healing. In Matthew 8, Jesus heals more people in a single chapter than anywhere else in the entire Bible. He heals a leper, a centurion's servant, without even going to him, Peter's mother-in-law, and then countless others who are brought to him all in a day's work. But you know what's disturbing about Jesus in this story and many others? He never went looking for someone to heal. The common denominator in all these healing stories and elsewhere in the Gospels is that Jesus doesn't go looking for people to heal. They always come to him. They take the initiative. They go. They speak. They call out. They send someone to go on their behalf. They ask someone to carry them. Never once did Jesus say, you know, in my mind, God has told me that there's a widow over in the next town that needs healing, and we should go. No, that never happens. Because people just constantly came to Jesus for healing, like many of the folks in chapter 8. And like those folks living in that oppressive first century world, we were also born into a world of suffering. From generational trauma to difficult childhoods to painful life experiences and the difficulty of finding our true selves, all while struggling under the crushing weight of political and economic stress and crisis. Someone here today needs to hear this. We aren't responsible for our wounds. We didn't put them there. They are not our fault. We didn't create them. But we have a duty to be active participants in our own healing. If we don't engage in the work, then our trauma will end up traumatizing someone else. Healing begins when the wounded take the initiative. But we can't be healed if we don't want to be. In college, I trained to be a lifeguard. And those of you familiar with that training will know that you have to demonstrate that you can rescue someone who is drowning. People drowning are frantic and panicked. They flail their arms and grab onto anybody and anything to stay afloat. And if you're not careful, they will take you down with them, even if you're a very trained swimmer. My trainer taught us that to rescue someone, you have to come up from behind them and secure them under the arms and swim to the shore. But she was a rather sadistic trainer. Her husband was a former offensive lineman at the University of Alabama. When it came time for us to rescue someone, he would be our pretend victim. And he took his job very seriously. When I dove in to rescue the Alabama lineman from his pretend drowning, the first thing he did was elbow me in the face, causing my nose to bleed. When I tried to approach him again, he tried to drown me twice, putting his entire body weight on top of mine. Finally, I got lucky hooked him around the neck and swam to the edge of the pool for the sake of my life. What did I learn from that experience? You can't rescue someone who does not want to be rescued. Just like you can't heal someone who does not want to be healed. Jesus didn't go looking for people in need of healing, but there are some times where he randomly encountered them in his travels. And in one of the most famous stories, he asks a man, "Do you want to be made well? Do you want to be made well?" It's a strange question. Who doesn't want to be made well? Clearly, Jesus must have believed that there were people who thought they wanted healing, but didn't understand what it meant or what would be required and weren't interested in doing the work. And so on this 80th anniversary, Myers Park, I wonder if we're brave enough to ask ourselves this question. Do we want to be well? Do we want to do the work necessary for healing? Or are we hoping healing will magically happen? And if we want to be well, then what are the rituals that we need to be a place of healing for the next generation? Since the time of George Heaton, we have been a people who believed in progressive revelation, the idea that God's truth is always evolving and unfolding. We won't survive in the 21st century with the theology we had in the 90s, let alone the 40s. We need a new theology that will help us reimagine what it means to be a community of healing in the future. People have always come to our church looking for something different, searching for healing from domineering doctrines and rigid dogma, healing from the Southern Baptist Convention, from fundamentalism and judgmentalism and other denominations, from theological malpractice and evangelical exclusion, from sexism and patriarchy and misogyny and toxic masculinity, from racism and xenophobia and white supremacy and religious bigotry, healing from homophobia and transphobia, healing from economic oppression and exploitation. And for 80 years, people have found it here. A wide diversity of people have found healing here in our inclusive community because of the freedom we offer and possess and our passion for love and justice. Yet if we want to continue to be that kind of community for another 80 years, we have to keep on dreaming about what people in the rapidly changing world around us need to find healing in this day and age, in a day of a polite and often unacknowledged hellscape of life in the 21st century. Baptism is a healing ritual. Maybe it's the foundational healing ritual for those who call themselves Baptists. Yet over the past 80 years, there's never been a baptism here on a Sunday morning in this sanctuary because we don't have a baptismal font in our sanctuary. Ours is in the chapel. One of our former senior ministers, Gene Owens, once proposed that we put a baptismal in the floor of the chancel right there between the two choir stalls, digging up the slate. His vision was not supported by the deacons or the congregation. But perhaps there's another way for us to think about baptism as a communal practice we can all participate in, a ritual of healing. I know it sounds blasphemous, but what if we did baptisms for infants and also believers? What if we did baptism more than once in our lives? What if we offered it whenever a person underwent a dramatic spiritual awakening, a change in their identity, a new sense of calling that requires sacred consecration? Is that too crazy? What if we offered baptism for people going through a gender transition to affirm their true identity so our community can welcome them fully and claim them as beloved children of God? Is that not what baptism is about? What if in addition to baptism and communion and weddings and funerals, we had other rituals for healing, rituals for people going through a divorce, rituals for people coming out of the closet, rituals for people going into or out of prison, rituals for miscarriages, rituals for infertility, rituals for adoption, rituals for retirement, rituals for caregivers, rituals for people called to social justice, rituals for people losing a job or getting a new job, rituals for people going through radiation and chemo, rituals for people recovering from addiction, rituals for survivors of sexual assault or harassment, Rituals for people struggling with mental illness. Rituals for people suffering memory loss or Alzheimer's. Rituals for people moving for the first time into assisted living. Rituals for people grieving the death of a beloved animal, a member of their family. These are the times when people need us the most, need community the most. And as the principalities of our world develop more ways to traumatize us, we're going to need more rituals to continue to be a community of healing. We are a church born 80 years ago in the wake of Pearl Harbor, during the Holocaust and one of the deadliest wars in human history. Now, 80 years later, we are being born again as we make our way out of one of the deadliest pandemics in human history. At a time when technological revolutions like a smartphone are happening every 3 years and churches are in precipitous decline. The grief we experience from all the loss and change and death is staggering. The intersecting pandemics of patriarchy and whiteness, homophobia, economic disparity, loneliness, isolation, anonymity, apathy, consumerism, they continue to plague us. Where will our world find healing from all that? It won't be in the Oval Office or the halls of Congress. I think you know that. It won't be in Silicon Valley or on social media. It won't be on Wall Street or in the Washington Post. It will only be found in the rituals of a loving and inclusive community where people come together to do the work of healing. Could that be this church? Will that be us? Will we be that kind of community in the future? If we keep dreaming together and imagining new rituals, and 20 years from now, on our 100th anniversary, people will not only say, "This is the place that I got baptized, and this is the place that I got married." They'll say, "These are the people who helped me through my divorce. These are the people who visited me when I was sick. These are the people who loved me through my mental illness. These are the people who held me when I lost my parents, when I lost my children. These are the people who encouraged me through my transition. These are the people who took care of me when I lost my job. These are the people who provided for me when I was struggling financially. These are the people who reminded me that I was a beloved child of God when I felt like I was nothing. These are the people who made sure I never felt alone. These are the people who sang and cried with me through all life's ups and downs. These are the people who showed me how to deconstruct all the toxic theologies I received and to build a new and authentic faith. These are the people who never let me be comfortable with the status quo, who allowed me the space to expand my vision of love and justice for all people. These are the people who refused to allow me to be swallowed up in patriarchy and white supremacy and homophobia and greed, but offered me a way to become a new creation with grace and love. These are the people who met me where I was, but would never leave me there. Gave me the space I needed to continue to grow. If people can say that about us in 20 years, then it won't matter how much money we have, how many members we have, how many buildings we have, how many endowments we have, because we will have carried the legacy of our forebears faithfully and continue to be the community of healing that the world needs us to be right here and right now. And according to the gospel of Jesus, if we can be that kind of community, then nothing else matters. Amen.